really across the political spectrum. I just got to say it. So I encourage people, if you are involved in another group, really think about taking on building ally skills work as a part of that group's function and work together on this issue. Lynn, your closing thoughts?
Don't stay up all night because somebody's wrong on the internet. This is the other thing I'd like to just say to do all this, but do get some sleep, people. Well, so thank you very much for tuning in this week. Come back next week when we'll be positively revolting as ever. Thank you all so much for listening. Thank you, Kristen, for being your wonderful engineer self. And
I also want to point out, I almost forgot, August 29th and 30th, support Black Restaurant Days in Portland. People are interested in something positive. Support Black-owned businesses.
Idea. Good idea.
And you can find out information about that on Facebook. Support Black Restaurant Days. It's an event page. All right. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Peña Flamenca de Portland, August 30th at the Headwaters Theater in Portland. This month, La Peña's show features artists from the Bay Area and France, including Andrea La Calena, Cristo Cortez, and Ricardo Diaz y Brenna McDonald. Again, that's Peña Flamenca de Portland, August 30th at the Headwaters Theater, located at 55 Northeast Farragut Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO is a proud sponsor of the 4th Portland Renters Assembly and their March for Housing Rights. The assembly is on August 26th at the Midland Library from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. There will be speakers on the housing crisis and community organizing, personal stories, large and small group discussion about political strategy, but also defending and otherwise supporting each other. Snacks and childcare will be provided. The march is on August 28th. It starts at City Hall at 6 p.m. with a rally and ends at the Multnomah County Building with another assembly. The theme will be Housing Rights for All and will encompass everything from homelessness to affordable housing to tenants' rights to at-cost public housing. More information can be found at kboo.fm under Community Events or portlandrentersassembly.info.
You gotta fight for your right!
And this is KBOO Portland. The time is 9:03 a.m. Coming up on Political Perspectives, host Doug McVeigh speaks with Johan Hardy about his best-selling book, Chasing the Scream, The First and Last Days of the War on Drugs. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, followed at 10:15 by Flashpoints, and at 11, we have the Digital Divide. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Those who are not members of the KBOO Foundation can remedy that oversight at kboo.fm. Just click where it says Donate Today. And now, Political Perspectives with your host, Doug McVeigh.
You're listening to Political Perspectives on KBOO Radio 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. I'm Doug McVeigh. My guest today is Johan Hari, author of Chasing the Scream, The First and Last Days of the Drug War. There is one thing that most politicians agree on these days, and that is that the war on drugs is a failure. Even officials who once championed the drug war now reject that term. It's not because of some new research or because the facts on the ground have changed. The facts have always supported drug policy reforms such as harm reduction, decriminalization, and even legalization. The thing is, in a policy debate, the facts are secondary. Sure, it's important to have them on your side, otherwise you open yourself up to ridicule and mockery. Accuracy is important, yet facts alone are not what win policy debates. Emotions determine how people vote and what they support, so you may win over their minds, yet the debate goes to the side that captures the heart. Human stories illustrate the failures of the drug war and reveal the irrationality inherent in the current global system of prohibition of some drugs. My guest today is one of the best storytellers on these topics, Johann Hari. Johann is a writer and journalist. His best-selling book, Chasing the Scream, was released earlier this year and is a must-read for anyone concerned with drugs, criminal justice, and/or public health. Johann, how are you doing today?
Hey, Doug. It's really good to be with you. I am under-caffeinated, but apart from that, I'm cheerful.
Well, terrific. Let's get right to it. Now, what made you decide to write Chasing the Scream?
I guess it was a couple of things, really. One of my earliest memories is of trying to wake up one of my relatives and not being able to. And I was very young then, so I didn't understand why. But as I got older, I realized that we had addiction in my family. And about 4 years ago, I realized we were coming up to the 100th anniversary of drugs being criminalized in the US and Britain. It's a crucial kind of cultural turning point. It's the moment when we decide to go to war against drug users and drug addicts. And, you know, I thought of myself as someone who knew quite a lot about this subject, partly because of my family's experience, partly because, I was a journalist. I'd written about these issues a lot for 10 years. But I kind of realized there were loads of really basic questions that I didn't know the answer to. Like, why did we go to war against drug users and drug addicts 100 years ago? Why do we carry on when, you know, it seems to be failing so badly? What are the alternatives actually like in practice? And what really causes drug use and drug addiction? And like you say, you know, there's a lot of facts out there, but I kind of felt I wasn't really discovering the answers in what I was reading for kind of several reasons. I realized that I didn't want to, I think part of the problem is when we discuss this so often, we talk in this pretty kind of abstract way. You know, we act like we're at a philosophy seminar and people say things like, well, what would it possibly mean to do these things? And what I wanted to do was to really sit with people whose lives have been changed one way or another by these approaches and listen to them and relate their stories to the best evidence. So I ended up going on this long journey. I didn't realize at the start how long it would be. I ended up traveling over 30,000 miles, 12 different countries, sitting with a crazy range of people from a transgender crack dealer in Brownsville, Brooklyn, to a hitman for the deadliest Mexican drug cartel in Ciudad Juarez, to a scientist who spends a whole load of time feeding hallucinogens to mongooses to see if they like them, to the only country in the world that's ever decriminalized all drugs since the drug war began, from cannabis to crack, with really incredible results. And I guess the main thing I realized from these amazing people that I met on my journey is almost everything we've been told about this subject is wrong. Drugs are not what we think they are. Drug use is not what we think it is. Drug addiction is not what we think it is. And the drug war is certainly not what we've seen on our TV screens for the last 100 years. And the alternatives to the drug war aren't what we've been told they are. So it's an incredibly exciting time to be writing and thinking about this subject when so many of our assumptions have been blown to pieces.
Let's start with some of the history. The Marijuana Tax Act of 1937 is the law that a lot of people think of as the start of U.S. drug prohibition, but we both know that's not how it began. In this country, the Harrison Narcotics Tax Act of 1914 started us down this path. Now, in your book, you talk about how the Prohibition Bureau chief, Harry Anslinger, began cracking down on opiate users. Could you tell us something about that?
Yeah. Where I open this is a story that blew my mind, that I learned from interviewing lots of people and looking in the archives and some of the already published work. I opened the book with the story of how Harry Anslinger, the inventor of the modern drug war, stalked and killed Billie Holiday, the great jazz singer. In 1939, Billie Holiday stood on stage in Midtown Manhattan, and she sang the song Strange Fruit, which most of your listeners will know is a song against lynching. And her goddaughter, Lorraine Feather, said to me, you've got to understand how shocking it was to have an African-American woman singing a song against lynching at that time in front of a white audience. Billie Holiday wasn't even allowed to walk through the front door of that hotel. She had to go through the service elevator because she was black. And she sings this song, and that night, she gets a warning from the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, from Anslinger's men. And it says, stop singing this song. And it might seem like a very strange place to begin the story of the drug war, because you think, well, what's that got to do with the war on drugs? Actually, it tells you what was the absolute core of the birth of the drug war and one of the key animating things that keeps it going today. That Harry Anslinger is probably the most... probably the most influential person who no one's ever heard of, right? He was a government bureaucrat who takes over the Department of Prohibition just as alcohol prohibition is ending. So he's got this huge government bureaucracy that's just been defeated and has basically nothing to do. And he really latches onto drugs and creates the drug war as the alternative purpose for his department. And he's really driven by two intense hatreds. One is a hatred of addicts, and the other is a hatred of African-Americans. But to understand, his hatred of African-Americans was so intense that he was regarded as an extreme racist in the 1920s and 1930s. His own senator said he should have to resign because he kept using the N-word in official police memos. He was a real hardcore racist. And to him, Billie Holiday was a symbol of everything he wanted to fight against. This was an African-American woman standing up to white supremacy. She was also a heroin addict. She had been raped as a young girl and then prostituted as a young girl, a very young girl. And she was trying to deal with the pain and the grief of what she'd experienced through very heavy alcohol use and later heroin use. And Anslinger becomes obsessed with her. It's fascinating to look at his writings and his files to see this. And he latches onto this moment and this song. And when Billie Holiday, effectively, Billie Holiday was an incredibly brave person, effectively says to Anslinger, when he says to stop singing the song, screw you, I'm an American citizen, I'm going to sing my song. And that's the moment when they resolve to destroy and break her. And it really begins this horrific and tragic process that I tell in the book that I learned largely from interviewing Billie Holiday's surviving friends and from some sources that hadn't previously been used. First of all, Anslinger sends an agent to stalk Billie Holiday. Now, he hated employing African-Americans, but you couldn't really send a white guy into Harlem to stalk Billie Holiday. It'd be kind of obvious. So he employs this guy called Jimmy Fletcher, an African-American agent. And the story of Jimmy Fletcher is kind of amazing. He follows her around for 2 years. This is amazing details about how he follows her around, gets to know her pretty well. And Billie Holiday was so amazing that Jimmy Fletcher fell in love with her. And his whole life, he felt ashamed of what he did next. She's busted. She's put on trial. Billie Holiday said, it was called the United States versus Billie Holiday, and that's how it felt. She's convicted. She's sent to prison for 18 months. She doesn't sing a word in prison. She's made to work in the pigsties in this prison. But the cruelest thing is what happens next. When she gets out, you needed a license to perform anywhere where alcohol was served. And Anslinger makes sure she doesn't get it. Her friend Yolanda Bavan, who's a great jazz singer herself, said to me, what's the cruelest thing you can do to a person? It's to take away the thing they love. They take away singing from Billie Holiday. She goes anywhere she can in the country where she can sing, but there's very few places. And she, you know, in that situation, unsurprisingly, she starts to relapse. By the way, this is what we do to addicts all over the United States and all over the world today. We put barriers between them and getting back to meaning and back to life. We make it harder for them to reconnect. And Billie Holiday, she starts using heroin again. She falls back into very severe alcoholism too. When she's in her early 40s, she collapses one day, also in Manhattan. She's taken to hospital. The first hospital refuses to have her because she's an addict. The second hospital agrees to take her, but she says to, she's convinced that the narcotics agents, Anslinger's men, are going to come for her, that they haven't finished with her. She says to one of her friends, Maylie Dufty, they're going to kill me in there. Don't let them. They're going to kill me. And she was right. She's taken into the hospital. She's diagnosed with advanced liver cancer. And because they don't give her any heroin in the hospital, she starts to go into heroin withdrawal, which is dangerous when you're very weak. It's not normally dangerous, but obviously if you're very weak or very old or whatever, it's dangerous. And they come, they arrest her on her deathbed. They handcuff her to her deathbed. They don't let her friends in to see her. They take away her record player and her candies. I spoke to the last surviving witness, the guy, last guy who was in the room, an extraordinary man called Eugene Callender. And one of her friends manages to insist that the hospital gives her methadone to stop this withdrawal. The doctors give her methadone. She starts to recover. Then after 10 days, Anslinger's men have it cut off. And she dies. One of her friends said she looked like she had been violently wrenched from life. She told that to the BBC. And I think this story about Billie Holiday and what was done to her is really important for all sorts of reasons. Firstly, it tells us what the start of the drug war was about. We tend to think, I had read Michelle Alexander's wonderful book, The New Jim Crow. I was aware that race was a factor, but I guess most of us think, if you were to say to the average guy on the street, why were drugs banned? You'd assume... I think I assume this, that it was the reasons that people would give now if you were asked them to justify the drug war. You know, they'd say, well, I don't want kids to use drugs. I don't want people to become addicted. That stuff barely comes up when you look at what was happening. Overwhelmingly, it was profound hatred and fear of African-Americans and Chinese-Americans and a desire to put them back in inverted commas, their place. You know, at the same time that Harry Anslinger found out that Billie Holiday was a heroin addict, he found out that Judy Garland, Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz, was a heroin addict. He advised her to take slightly longer vacations and reassured the studio she was going to be fine. Spot the difference between Billie Holiday, who's African-American, and Judy Garland, who was white. That's a difference that runs right through to the present day. So I think it's important to understand the thing that most helped me from meeting Billie Holiday's friends and from learning this story, though, was actually something a bit different. You know, I mentioned that we had addiction in my family. And, you know, I think if you're honest about it, anyone who cares about this issue, I think one of the reasons why the debate about the war on drugs is so charged is because actually it runs through the hearts of each of us, right? We all have a compassionate part of ourselves, almost all of us. And almost all of us have an Anslinger inside our heads that looks at the addicts we know and thinks, somebody should just stop you. And one of the things that really helped me in a process of kind of thinking differently about addicts was to realize that addicts can be heroes. And it really helped me thinking about Billie Holiday, you know. No matter what they did to her, Billie Holiday never stopped singing that song. You know, she went to the deep South where it was really dangerous and she sang that song. She went wherever they would have her. And I think there's something really extraordinary in that story. And I then went on to meet some really heroic addicts who've made some incredible changes in the world later in different places. And I think that to know that, you know, you can be in the pit of addiction and still be a hero and still do such an amazing and brave thing, that really helped me.
You're listening to Political Perspectives on KBOO Radio 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. I'm Doug McVeigh. My guest today is Johann Hari, author of Chasing the Scream. Back a long time ago, we thought of, and still probably some people do, think of drug use, drug addiction as a sort of moral failing. So the law was to uplift those folks who used drugs, who were addicted. Then... We've changed somewhat. We've evolved somewhat. We have the people like NIDA director Nora Volkow and many others who call drug addiction a brain disease. So we've moved from a moral failing to they're just sick. Yet we know from research that it's really neither. You. In your book, talk about Bruce Alexander, a Canadian psychologist, and his experiment, which is called Rat Park. Could you tell the listeners about that?
Yeah, remind me to come back to the question of NIDA, because I think this is really fascinating, and I haven't talked about it in many interviews, and I think it's really important. This is the thing, this thing about Rat Park and a lot of the implications and the other things that flow from it. It's the thing that most surprised me in the research for the book, because it tells us that the most basic ideas we have about addiction are wrong. If you had said to me 4 years ago, what causes, say, heroin addiction? I would have looked at you like you were a little bit stupid. And I would have said, well, obviously heroin causes heroin addiction. That's a ridiculous question. Right. We think that if you, me, and the first 20 people listening to this show, if we all used heroin together for 20 days, on day 21, we'd all be heroin addicts because, you know, there are chemical hooks in heroin that our bodies would start to physically need. And we'd have a ravenous craving for it. And that's what addiction is. That's certainly what I believed. In fact, that's what I thought I had witnessed with people I love. The first thing that alerted me to the fact there's something not right about this story is when it was explained to me, if I step out of this interview now and I get hit by a car and I break my hip, I'll be taken to hospital and I'll be given a lot of a drug called diamorphine for the pain. Diamorphine is heroin. It's just a medical name for heroin. It's much stronger heroin than I could ever buy on the streets because the stuff you buy from dealers is very heavily contaminated. Only about 30% of it is actually heroin, whereas obviously the doctors, they give you 100% the pure stuff. Anyone listening to this who's ever had a hip replacement operation, for example, has taken a lot of heroin. Now, loads of people in a hospital near you are being given heroin the whole time. If what we think about addiction is right, what should happen to those people? Some of them, at least, should become addicts, right? This has been studied very carefully. It doesn't happen. And yet they're exposed to all the same chemical hooks as any addict you'll see on the street. And when I learned that, it was so weird. I didn't know what to do with it. And I only began to understand it when I went and interviewed the guy you mentioned and spent a lot of time with, Professor Bruce Alexander. He's a professor of psychology in Vancouver who did this really important experiment. Bruce explained to me that the idea of addiction we have, the one that we were just talking about, comes in part from a series of experiments that were done earlier in the 20th century. They're really easy experiments. Your listeners can do them at home if they're feeling a little bit sadistic. You get a rat and you put it in a cage and you give it two water bottles. One is just water and the other is water laced with either heroin or cocaine. If you do that, the rat will almost always prefer the drugged water and almost always kill itself. You might remember the famous Partnership for Drug-Free America advert that showed this and said something like, you know, it will happen to you. In the 70s, Professor Alexander comes along and looks at this experiment and thought, well, hang on a minute. We're putting these rats in an empty cage. They've got nothing to do except take this drug. Let's do this differently. So Professor Alexander built a really different cage that, as you say, he called Rat Park, which is basically like paradise for rats. Anything a rat could want in life, it's got in this cage. It's got loads of colored balls. It's got loads of cheese. It's got loads of friends. It can have loads of sex. And it's got both the water bottles, the normal water and the drugged water. But this is the fascinating thing. In Rat Park, they don't like the drugged water. They almost never use it. None of them ever use it compulsively. None of them ever overdose. So bear in mind, we're going from almost 100% compulsive use and overdose when they're in the isolated cages to no overdose when they're in the happy, connected cages. There's loads of things that flow from this and loads of human examples I can talk about if you like. But this really prompts, I think, a different way of thinking about addiction. And there's lots of evidence for this, but I'll just give you the kind of headline summary, which is that this guy called Peter Cohen, who's a professor in Amsterdam, who talks about this. He says that we shouldn't talk about addiction. We should talk about bonding. Human beings, like rats, are social creatures, and we have an innate need to bond and connect. And when we're happy and healthy, we'll bond and connect with each other. But if you can't do that, because you're isolated or traumatized or beaten down by life, you will bond and connect with something that gives you some sense of relief. Now that, and some sense of not being present with your pain. That might be gambling. That might be pornography. That might be alcohol. It might be cocaine. But you will bond with something because that's our nature. There's another, I'll give you just one more human example. at the same time as Rat Park, there was a very big human human experiment into this principle happening. It was called the Vietnam War. In Vietnam, a really high proportion of American soldiers were using a whole load of heroin. And if you look at the news reports from the time, there's this real panic because they think, my God, we're going to have hundreds of thousands of junkies on the streets of the United States when the war ends. These addicts, they were followed home. They were studied very carefully. And it turned out, overwhelmingly, 95% of them just stopped. They didn't go to rehab. They didn't, you know, go into terrible withdrawal. They just stopped. Now, if you believe the old theory of addiction, that it's all about chemical hooks, that makes absolutely no sense. They've been exposed to the same chemical hooks as any addict on the street. But if you understand Professor Alexander's theory of addiction, it makes perfect sense. You know, if you're taken out of a hellish, pestilential jungle where you don't want to be and you could die at any moment, and you're put back in your, you know, nice life in Wichita, Kansas with your friends and your family, well, that's the equivalent of being taken out of that first cage and being put into the second cage. And so, of course, you want to be present in your life and you don't want to be out of it.
Stuff that makes great sense, and yet it's so, and yet it's still controversial. NIDA, as we started to mention earlier, the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, our federal government's drug research agency, Dr. Nora Volkow, is a strong proponent of the brain disease theory of addiction. She uses her brain scans to try and show that it's all about a brain disease. And so addicts, people who have a drug dependence, they're sick and they need some kind of help. What have you learned about NIDA? You asked me to remind you. It is a disturbing agency. They have they've done some good stuff, and yet they've done some really awful stuff.
I think it's a really fascinating area. This NIDA was set up by Richard Nixon in the early 70s to basically find scientific evidence to back up the drug war. I've interviewed the first head of NIDA, Robert Dupont, who's a very interesting, complex figure. And I think it's really important to understand several things about NIDA. Firstly, when you think about this dichotomy between are addicts morally depraved or are they just sick, I think a little bit like there's this very interesting thing about gay people in the 1870s, right? In the 1870s, you have the first people to self-identify as gay in, you know, more than a millennia, publicly self-identify as gay. And a lot of them say, we're not evil, we're sick, right? And at the time, this is interpreted as a great liberation for them because, you know, if that's the choice, I'm gay myself. If I had a choice between being evil or being sick, I'd choose to be sick, right? I'd choose to think of myself that way. Now, of course, we would regard both those ways of thinking about gay people as crazy, right? We'd say, well, you're not evil or sick, you're just different, right? And it's in the case of gay people, it's a difference that obviously causes no harm to anyone else. Now, I don't want to take that analogy too far. Of course, you know, being an addict is a state that causes terrible pain and distress to you, whereas being gay is nothing like that. So I don't want to take that analogy too far, but I do think there's an important parallel. And I think that the dichotomy that NIDA sets up is in some significant ways, really harmful. So although I think they are largely well-intentioned people. So think about Nora Volkow, who presents this idea that addiction is a brain disease, right? And the evidence that she presents for this is that, by the way, Nora Volkow is one of the very few people who I interviewed hundreds of people for my book. She's one of the very few people who just would not give me an interview. And I think it's very revealing. She never gives interviews to anyone who might question her in any way, putting other theories, which I think is quite revealing. So what they do, NIDA, is they show you brain scans of addicts, and they'll show you a brain scan of an addict and they'll say, this looks different to a non-addict's brain scan. They're entirely right. It is true that addict's brains look different to non-addict's brains. What they fail to explain is, right, so we have this concept called neuroplasticity. It basically means that brains evolve, right? How you use your brain will change according to how you use it. In the same way, if I start lifting loads of weights, my arm muscles will get bigger. They'll grow over time. So if I use my arm differently, my arm will grow differently and look differently. And indeed, if you did an x-ray or a scan of my arm, it would look very differently. That wouldn't mean I had an arm disease. It would mean I was using my arm differently. In the same way, if you use your brain differently, so if you use your, for example, London taxi drivers have to memorize the map of London to pass a very difficult exam called the knowledge in order to get the license to be a taxi driver, right? So they have to know the map of London in their head. If you do brain scans of the of London taxi drivers, the part of their brain, I think it's part of the hippocampus, that relates to spatial awareness is much bigger than it would be in you and me, right? That doesn't mean they've got a hippocampus disease. It means they use their brain differently. So what the brain disease, by looking at brain scans, one of the key things they're getting wrong is they're getting the order of causation wrong. The reason why addicts have looked different on brain scans is because they've used their brains differently. Why have they used their brains differently? It's because of the underlying social factors that we're describing. It's not because there was inherently something differently wrong with their brain. There's plenty of evidence that's not right. But also there's so many other things that the brain disease theory can't explain. I'll give you, by the way, a fantastic guy to talk to about this is Professor Carl Hart at Columbia University. I'm very grateful to you for explaining some of these things to me. There's loads of different things that they can't explain. I'll give you one example. Well, we've already talked about one. How do they explain the Vietnam soldiers? If heavy drug use causes a brain disease, how do they explain the fact that these soldiers came home from Vietnam and overwhelmingly just stopped using? How do they account for the fact that the overwhelming majority of addicts stop of their own accord without any rehab? That's a overwhelmingly proven fact, right? Most addicts will stop after about 10 years, right? They can't, if your brain is hijacked and taken over, and as Nora Volkow says, you lose your capacity for pleasure and for, you know, taking pleasure in normal things because of a neurochemical process, how do they explain that? That they can't. Now, I want to stress, this is not about undermining for the slightest second how much pain and agony addicts are in and how much we need to love them and show compassion and care for them. That is the whole purpose of my whole way of talking and thinking about this. But I want to explain why it's really dangerous and harmful to call to tell people a false explanation of why they're addicted. Stanton Peale, who's a wonderful man, I'm sure you know his work, Doug, he wrote a fantastic book called Love and Addiction, amongst other stuff. He's a real expert on addiction. Cites a study that I was just reading the other day, actually, about I don't want to get the details wrong. I haven't written about this, so I haven't memorized the details in the same way. So I may be remembering some small elements of this wrong. But if I remember correctly, it's a study that looked at factors about recovering addicts. And one of the things it found is that addicts who believe that they have a brain disease called addiction had a significantly lower recovery rate than addicts who didn't. People are very vulnerable to the stories you tell them. And if you tell them a story that their brain has been hijacked and their neural circuitry no longer works, which is what Nora Volkow says with no evidence, that's a very dangerous story to tell a person. A, it's not true. And B, let's look at another example, which I think is really important. There are societies where there are significant falls in addiction, right? I've been to them. I've reported from them for Chasing the Scream, the book we're talking about. And what happened in those societies is what happened that there was a sudden evolution in the human brain that meant that brains worked differently. Was there a mass intervention in the brains of the addicts in those countries? No, that's not what happened at all. I'll tell you what really happened. Let's look at one of them, Portugal. In the year 2000, Portugal had one of the highest rates of heroin addiction anywhere in Europe. 1% of the population was addicted to heroin, which is kind of incredible when you think about it. And every year, they tried the American way more. They arrested more people. They imprisoned more people. And every year, the problem got worse. And one day, the prime minister and the leader of the opposition got together, and they basically said, like, look, we can't go on like this. We can't have a country where every year more and more people are heroin addicts. What are we going to do? And they decided to set up a panel of scientists and doctors. And they said to them, you guys go away, look at the best evidence about addiction and all of this and drug policy. and come back and tell us what to do. But they did a really smart thing. They agreed in advance that they were going to do whatever the panel recommended. It'd be like if Obama and Boehner got together and agreed. I mean, it's difficult to imagine them agreeing on the time of day, but you know, got and agreed, you know, agreed in advance they were going to do whatever a drug panel recommended. So the panel, led by this amazing man I got to know called Dr. Joao Goulart, went away. They looked at all the research, including Rat Park, and they come back and they say, decriminalize all drugs from cannabis to crack. And but this is the crucial next step. Take all the money we used to spend on arresting and imprisoning drug users and spend it instead on turning their lives around. And what's interesting is it's not what Nora Volkow recommends. They do some things like rehab. They do some residential rehab, but that does have some real value. But overwhelmingly, what they do is the opposite of what Nora Volkow recommends. They did the opposite of the drug war. So what they did is they set up a huge program of job creation for addicts. The goal was to make sure that every addict in Portugal had something to get out of bed for in the morning. So say you used to be a mechanic. They'd go to a garage and they'd say, if you employ this guy for a year, we'll pay half his wages. And, you know, I spoke to lots of addicts who found that as they got back into normal life, they started to get friends and relationships. They started to kind of reconnect. So they started to have connections that gave them pleasure beyond the connection they had to their drug. And it's been 15 years. It'll be 15 years this year since this experiment began. Injecting drug use is down by 50%. 50%. You know, one of the ways you know overdose is massively down. HIV transmission is massively down. One of the ways you know that it's been so successful is that almost nobody wants to go back in Portugal. You know, they have six main political parties. None of them want to go back. I went and interviewed the guy who led the opposition to the decriminalisation at the time, a guy called Joao Figueira, who said what I think a lot of your listeners will probably be thinking now, which is, you know, surely if you decriminalise all drugs, all sorts of you have all sorts of disasters. And he said to me, I'm paraphrasing, the exact words are in the book, you know, everything I said would happen didn't happen. And everything the other side said would happen did. And he talked about how he felt ashamed that he'd spent 20 years arresting and harassing drug users. The reason why I mentioned that in relation to Nora Volkow, I will personalise it on her, with NIDA more generally, is, you know, big social changes lead to falls or rises in addiction. If addiction is a brain disease, that doesn't make any sense. You know, if there's just so much they can't explain. There's a very revealing quote, a former head of NIDA, the one who was the head in the 80s, I'm blanking on his name, but this quote is given in Sally Satel's excellent book, Brainwashed. He said something like, no, of course addiction isn't a brain disease, but if that's what it takes for me to sell it to Congress, and for them to, you know, treat addicts a little bit more nicely, then fine, I'll do it. You know, I do think there's an element where the people who promoted this idea, I'm sure Nora Volkow, to be fair to her, does sincerely believe it. But, you know, the people who promoted this, they believe that this is the way to promote compassion. I think we have to look at, we shouldn't say things that aren't true. And it's not true, right? It's just not right what they're saying. But actually, I think they fail to see that by telling that story, they're inadvertently undermining addicts. There's a much more empowering story. It's what they told them in Portugal. It's that any of us, if we lost our sense of meaning, if we lost our sense of connections, would become addicts. And the way to bring you back to us, the way to not want to be addicted or to be out of it all the time, is to help you to build and strengthen connections and bonds and love and compassion. And over time, you know, if you do that, your brain will change and it will be more receptive to the world, just like it changed when you started using drugs heavily. That our brains change the whole time according to how we use them, and you are not trapped and you have not been hijacked and you've not been taken over. And just to say one other thing about NIDA that was very interesting, I went and interviewed Eric Sterling. He's a fascinating man. He you might know him, Doug. He wrote the drug laws for the United States between 1979 and 1989. He was the lawyer on the House committee whose job was to draft the laws. And Eric said to me, we were talking about how the science in NIDA works. And it's worth remembering, NIDA funds 90% of all the scientific research into illegal drugs in the whole world, right? So they are the dominant figures in the global funding of this. And I said to Eric something like, you know, what would happen if NIDA started talking about these other causes of addiction that are not to do with the drug themselves? And Eric said, I spoke to him a couple of years ago, so I'm completely paraphrasing, but he said, well, the head of NIDA would know not to do that because the job of NIDA is to find good reasons to continue fighting the drug war. But in the extremely unlikely event that someone from NIDA did start saying that, they'd be called before a Senate subcommittee, before the House, and they'd be fired. You know, so they know not to say these things. Now, again, I want to stress, it's not, I don't think it's that people at NIDA are dishonest, or I think the science has been skewed by the people who fund it. That's not difficult for people to understand. You can be, you know, if 90% of all the research, if all the 90% of all the journalism in the United States was funded by Michael Bloomberg, Michael Bloomberg would end up looking pretty good in the American media without anyone having to lie about Michael Bloomberg or consciously distort what they were doing. You know, it's just, you would end up, you know, not to anger your paymasters, right? This is a bit like Noam Chomsky's theory about why the corporate media is the way it is. And I think exactly the same thing is true of NIDA. I didn't actually write very much about this in the book, so I'm glad to get a chance to. The book is mostly, as you say, stories about people and so on. But I think that's a really, that stuff about brain hijacking is really important.
You're listening to Political Perspectives on KBOO Radio 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. I'm Doug McVeigh. My guest today is Johann Hari, author of Chasing the Scream. It's terribly important. Again, and it's, you know, the facts simply point toward a different approach than the one that we take in this country. And but as I said, the facts aren't what win policy debates. It's that it's the stories. It's winning the hearts, not just the minds.
And, what's interesting about that, Doug, you know, Irving Yalom, the great psychoanalyst, said once, you know, passion will always trump reason, so we need to turn reason into a passion. And I think there's something about you're absolutely right that, you know, a fact alone will not change someone's mind, but I do think you can make people passionate about figuring out what actually works. You know, there's going to be a huge number of people, and you know this better than me, listening to this, who have addicts in their life, addicts they love, drug users they love, or people whose lives have been destroyed by the drug war in other ways. And a lot of the book is about the other ways. For example, the horrific violence caused by prohibition, which has nothing to do with addiction. And especially by far the worst thing I saw in the process of researching the book was the time I spent in northern Mexico and what's happened there, and which is all drug war violence. And we can come back to that, I'm sure, if you want to. But, you know, I think we can – those people listening to this will be passionate about figuring out what genuinely works, because at the moment what they're told is to do things that don't work. If I think about – I thought about this a lot when I was writing Chasing the Scream, because – you know, one of my motives was I had some people very close to me who I love, who have addiction problems, who I was very frightened for. And, you know, it really helped me when I came back, because, you know, anyone who loves an addict will know there's a part of you that's very angry. And you know, one of the ways we're taught to treat people is, I guess, typified by that reality show Intervention, where, you know, you're told, for anyone who hasn't seen it, you know, you kind of, everyone knows the addict, gathers them together and basically shames them and threatens them and says, if you don't do what we tell you to, which is go to rehab, which, by the way, doesn't work. We can talk about that if you want. If you don't do this, we're going to cut you off. We're going to disconnect you. And I, you know, when I came back, I was thinking so much about Rat Park and about Portugal and about a lot of the other places I went to. And I kind of thought, oh, right, that approach, that intervention approach is basically, it's the logic of the drug war imported into our private lives. And it's a disaster. It's actually the worst thing you can do with an addict is to make your connection to them more tenuous and more threatened. What I try to do with the addicts in my life is, you know, to try to strengthen the connection with them. I can't tell you it's easy. I can't tell you I do it consistently. But, you know, to say to them, I love you, whether you're using or you're not, I love you unconditionally. If you need me, I will come and sit with you. You're not alone. You're not on your own. And I think that's the crucial message that we need to be we need to be communicating to addicts. Exactly the opposite of shape up or you're out.
Let's talk a little bit about, you mentioned Mexico and your time there. A lot of people don't like the phrase drug war, but in some parts of the world, that is an absolutely accurate and chilling description of what happens. American drug policies wreak havoc. And in your book, you tell the story of a woman from Chihuahua, Mexico, Maricela Escobedo Ortiz, and her fight for justice. Could you tell the listeners about her?
Yeah, I would say that actually I think the drug war is actually an apt description for within the United States as well, for reasons we can come back to. But Maricela, I found this one of the hardest parts of the book to write. In Ciudad Juarez, which is a city on the border, it's Mexican side of the border, but it's basically the border with Texas. Just the other side is El Paso, and it's a major drug supply route into the United States. About 70% of the economy of Juarez is made up of these illegal drugs. Maricela Escobedo was a nurse in Ciudad Juarez who also owned a little kind of woodwork store. She had nothing to do with drugs. She never used any drugs. She never sold any drugs. Nothing to do with the drug war, except that her city was then taken over and it affected her life profoundly. Maricela had a daughter called Ruby who was 14. And something happened with her. It was seemed a bit strange at first. Maricela was approached one day by a guy called Sergio, who was in his early 20s, who was unemployed. And he basically said, oh, I've just had a baby. I need a job. Will you take me on? And Maricela was a kind of soft-hearted woman, and she said, sure, I'll give you a job. So she gave the guy a little job on her woodwork stall. And a couple of months later, Maricela discovered that he was sleeping with her 14-year-old daughter, Ruby. And of course, she was appalled, and she fired him. And then she found out that Ruby was still sleeping with this guy. So she went to the police, and she basically said, look, you've got to stop this guy. He's an adult. My daughter's a child. Police didn't do anything. Maricela didn't really understand why. She kind of thought they were incompetent. Anyway, she keeps trying to stop her daughter. The daughter keeps running away. Then she finds out that Ruby is pregnant. And she's obviously devastated and really worried. And her daughter keeps running away to be with this guy. And the police keep refusing to do anything. And so Maricela does her best. She keeps her daughter in touch with her. Ruby has the baby. And one day, Maricela turns up to see her daughter at the house she was living in with Sergio. She was only 15 at this point. And Sergio was there with the baby. And he said, Ruby's gone. And Maricela said, what do you mean? And and Sergio said, she's run away. She's run off with another man. And Maricela said, what? And left her child? No, she hasn't done that. And Sergio said, yeah, well, she has. She's gone. And Maricela was really puzzled, and she left, and she didn't hear anything from Ruby, which is very unusual. And Maricela became convinced something had gone wrong, and she started to distribute in the neighborhood leaflets with pictures of Ruby on them, just saying, have you seen my daughter? This is the moment when the drug war is really starting to charge through Juarez. There's around 20 killings a day, butcherings, beheadings, but Maricela doesn't think this has got anything to do with, what's that got to do with her or her daughter? Her daughter didn't use drugs, her daughter didn't have anything to do with the cartels. So she just kind of proceeds as she would had the drug war not come to Juarez. And one day, Maricela is contacted by a kid called Angel. And he says to her, I know something about your daughter, I want to see you. So she goes to see him. This boy is terrified. And he says, he refuses to speak. She has to drive him way out into the desert. And in the desert, he says, I helped to dispose of your daughter's body. Sergio killed her because he thought she was going to leave him, and we dumped her body in this place. It was actually a place where pig bones, where pigs are fed. And Marisela goes there, and they find the remains of her daughter. And she goes to the police, and the police eventually arrest Sergio, and he's put on trial. And in the witness box, he breaks down in tears, and he apologizes to Marisela for what he's done. And a couple of weeks later, he's mysteriously acquitted of all charges and disappears. And Marisela doesn't understand what's happened. And she then finds out that Sergio is part of one of the deadliest Mexican drug cartels, Los Zetas. And what that means is the Zetas, if you think about basically the way it works, it was explained to me when I first went to Juarez. I was shown around by this amazing journalist there called Julian Cardona, and he kept introducing me to people who'd been killed by the police, and at some families of people who've been killed by the police. And at some point I said to him, you know, Julian, I've got to meet people who've been families of people who've been killed by the cartels. You know, that's an important part of the story. And he just laughed and said, Johan, you don't understand. If the cartels want to kill someone, they just pay the police to do it. They've taken over. They own the state, right? And that is what Marisela was learning. Sergio, at that point she discovered, was a member of the Zetas, and that meant he is the law. He's above the law. He can do whatever he wants, and the police and the courts will just let him go. Now, Marisela refused to accept that she did not live in a civilized society of laws, right? She just would not accept what the drug war had done to northern Mexico. She, I'll tell the full story in Chasing the Scream, but she basically turned herself into a detective, and she spends 2 years tracking Sergio all over Mexico. She walks through the desert with this band of women whose daughters have also disappeared, had also been murdered. And they walk through the desert and they track him all over Mexico. And after 2 years, Marisela finds him. And she calls the police, and the police let him go again. And she's heartbroken. And she walks to the governor's mansion in Chihuahua, to the state capital. And she stands outside it and she says, we're not leaving here until he is arrested, until we've got justice. We won't live in a country where this happens. And she stays there for weeks and weeks. And she announces she's going to have Christmas dinner on the steps of the governor's mansion. And she gives this one day, she gives this really rousing speech, calling for all the women whose daughters have disappeared to come out and join her. And a man walks up to her in front of all the cameras and all the police, and he shoots her in the face. And I got to know her kids. And to me, that story is such an important symbol of so much of what happened, what the drug war does, right? And it's important to understand it. And this is why I say that war is the right word for what happens within the United States as well. If people want to understand, by the way, it's worth, I should just say, the head of the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, who just stood down, Michelle Leon Hart, was asked in Senate testimony, in a Senate subcommittee, about the fact that they said to her, 60,000 innocent civilians have died in Mexico in the last 8 years. In fact, that figure was completely wrong. It's about 160,000. But anyway, she was this put to her, and she said, these were her exact words, it's a sign of success in the war on drugs. She was describing Marisela's death as a sign of success. That should be a national and international scandal. Americans are better than that. As a person whose wages you pay, and it is shaming that she was made to stand down over a minor and petty corruption scandal and not over that whole way of thinking. But anyway, that's set that aside for a second. If people want to understand what causes violence like that, right? We have to step back a bit. And the best way to explain it is, imagine if after this interview, you decided you want to go and steal a bottle of vodka, right? You go to the local the drinks aisle at Walmart or your local liquor store. And if they catch you stealing the bottle, they will call the police and the police will take you away. So that individual liquor store doesn't need to be violent. It doesn't need to be intimidating. If, however, you decide you want to steal some cocaine or some cannabis, and you go up to the local seller of that, obviously he can't ring the cops if he catches you, right? Like, the cops would arrest him. So he has to be violent and intimidating. He has to fight back. I learned this mainly through the story of this incredible transgender crack dealer in Brownsville, Brooklyn, called Chino Hardin, who I interviewed over 3 years and is a main figure in my book. But that dynamic, so that not only does that dealer have to be violent to protect his trade, he has to establish his trade through violence, and he has to fend off rivals through violence. So it creates what one sociologist calls a culture of terror. You have to be at war the whole time, right? You have to establish through violence that you're such a badass that no one will dare to take you on, right? Otherwise, you'll just be robbed blind. You'll be screwed. That dynamic, Milton Friedman, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, calculated that that dynamic causes an additional 10,000 murders every year in the United States. You know, and it's part of the problem is when we talk about, you'll often hear on the news the phrase drug-related violence. They'll talk about all these killings in Chicago at the moment, and they'll call it drug-related violence, right? And what people think that means when you hear that phrase is, oh, someone used drugs and, you know, killed someone. It's not what's happening at all. It was a very detailed study of this. Actually, a tiny fraction of the drug-related violence is an individual using drugs and losing it. The vast majority is this violence we're talking about, prohibition-caused violence. It is violence caused by the fact that these drugs are illegal, right? Al Capone wasn't getting drunk and going and killing people. He was killing people to control the prohibitive market in alcohol. Ask yourself today, does the head of Heineken go and shoot in the face the head of Smirnoff? Of course not, because it's a legal, regulated trade. All that violence stops the moment it's a legal and regulated trade. I saw this in Switzerland, where they've legalized heroin. There are no violent heroin dealers in Switzerland. They don't exist, right? It's a legal, regulated trade. So I think it's really important to understand that this horrific violence in northern Mexico and this broader violence in the United States and all over the world wherever drugs are banned is entirely preventable, right? We can stop it if we want to.
You're listening to Political Perspectives on KBOO Radio 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. I'm Doug McVeigh. My guest today is Johann Hari, author of Chasing the Scream. Do you have any closing thoughts for our listeners, Johann?
Oh, well, what would I say as a closing thought? I always feel quite fluent until someone asks for a closing thought. I would say that all the people that I've talked about, that we've been talking about, you can hear my interviews with them at the book's website, which is www.chasingthescream.com. The book's subtitle is The First and Last Days of the War on Drugs. So on that website, people can hear all those interviews. They can see a list of organizations they can join in their area to fight for you know, an end to the drug war. They can see loads of videos of me being interviewed and other stuff. They can find out where to get the book. But also, I would like to say to people of Oregon, you know, to congratulate them. It's amazing. People in Oregon organized in a really smart and impressive campaign to legalize marijuana in your state. What the decision that you have taken is inspiring people all over the world. I've just been in France and Germany. People are hugely inspired by what you've done. You should be really proud of yourselves. You know, I only ever once saw my father cry. It was my dad lived in Berlin for a long time when it was a divided city between East and West. They used to actually live very near the Berlin Wall. And when I was 10, I came home. We lived in London. When I was 10, I came home. And my mum and dad were watching the TV and they were crying. And I was like, oh my God, has someone died? What's happened? And people were tearing down the Berlin Wall. And my dad said, you'll understand when you're older. We never thought we'd live to see this. And when I heard the referendum results from Washington and Colorado, and then I saw this following the other states, I thought of that moment and I kind of thought, you know, this is the first axe into the Berlin Wall. This is a really big deal. You know, the US cannot go to this UN meeting next year and do what they've done for the last 100 years and bang their fist on the table and say, you've got to fight this to the last inch because of what you, the people of Oregon and Washington and Colorado, have achieved. And that's an incredible thing that is going to have effects. Obviously, it's going to have fantastic effects in Oregon, but it's going to have effects all over the world. And as I say, I think you should be really proud of it. And Doug, I should say as well, you should be really proud of the work that you've done with Drug War Facts for years and years. That is really one of the most invaluable resources on the internet. And you should be really proud because you've put a huge amount of work into that. I see that being cited all over the world. It's absolutely crucial and invaluable what you've done. You know, I've had people cite it from off the top of my head, I can remember people citing it in Uruguay, in Mexico, in Germany, in Vietnam. I heard someone, you've had a huge influence in the work that you've done, and you should be really proud of that. It's a crucial part of the fight that we've been part of.
Well, you're kind, but as I said at the top of this, the facts have always been on our side. It's catching the minds. That's one part, but capturing the hearts, that's what really does win. It's the passion, as you said, that would really drive that will really drive change and make it a reality. And it takes people telling the stories and communicating the reasons why people should care to make that happen. And that is what you have done, and really well. It's a very impressive book, Chasing the Scream, the First and Last Days of the War on Drugs.
This is KBOO Portland. That was Doug McVeigh speaking with Johan Hari about his best-selling book, Chasing the Scream, the First and Last Days of the War on Drugs. It's 9:59 a.m., coming up at 10. Air Cascadia with your host, Chris Andre. So keep it locked right here, KBOO Portland.
The War on Drugs, that's a tough act to follow. Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Friday, August 14th, 2015, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. Coming up, 15 minutes of jiggery pokery news, comments, and more. Well, our guests today are outstanding people who have done work that all of us would indeed want to add to our list of stuff that we are proud of. And indeed,